Numbers. So we're going to be doing chapters 25, 26, and 27 today. But again, by way of memory, questions from last week. What was the name of the man who was to curse Israel? What was his name? Do y'all remember from last week? Which one?
Balaam.
Good job. Balaam. Okay, so who asked him to do it and where was he from? Good answer, Molly. That iPad works really good. Now, I'm sure it was your notes too, wasn't it? So Balak, and where was he from? Who did he represent? What? Where was he from? Okay. It will come to memory soon enough on this. Okay, so this one then, who won the battle that we talked about last week?
God.
Oh, good. Good Sunday school answer. That's actually a trick question because there wasn't a battle left. No, there was no battle. Remember, he won? Balak came to Balaam, said, curse him for me and everything. Wouldn't have anything to do with that, and that's where it ended. But now we begin, and that was kind of like a good thing. So with every good thing, there's going to be the bad stuff. Oh, not yet. This is just a timeline I wanted to throw up here for you guys to let you know where we are in terms of chapter 25. And if you can look real quick, let me get my finger in here. Here we are right there, Numbers 10. So we've been 38 years, 3 months, and 10 days, and then Numbers chapter 25 is going to be taking place. So we've been almost through that entire 40-year period now of wandering through the desert. We're getting close to going to the promised land. Not quite there, but we're getting pretty close. So that's how we're looking at the period of time associated with Numbers today. And then also in their wanderings, I know that this is somewhat of an eye chart for you and everything, but the bottom line on this thing, if I can, is this area right here, this is where we're finishing up. This is Shittim right here at the very end of that. It's on the going to be the east side of the Jordan. They haven't crossed over yet, and that's where they're poised before going into the promised land, but some things have to take place first. However, in chapter 25 it begins, while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab, for they invited the people to sacrifice of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. The Lord said to Moses, take all the leaders of the people and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. So Moses said to the judges of Israel, each of you slay his men who have joined themselves to Baal of Peor. Now first of all, Baal of Peor, Peor is a location, but it was a Moabite god, which specifically was associated with sexual acts and that kind of thing. Not very pretty thing. Numbers 25 talks about them joined, and that joined is like the word yoke, associated with oxen and that kind of thing. So the people of Israel had yoked themselves, if you will, to this other god, which made our God very angry at them. God tells Moses, I want all the leaders, round up all the leaders, we're going to just wipe out all the leaders. Moses, in turn, tells his judges to slay the men who have joined themselves or yoked themselves to Baal of Peor. I don't believe Moses is being disobedient in that. I believe that's just the way the context of this works out, to where all of them that were associated with this act were going to be disciplined. The other thing that's associated with this is the fact that those leaders should have known something was wrong and they should have taken action. So even though they may not have actually been one of the ones to bow down, they should have been the ones to take care of things, make things right. The other thing that's kind of ugly to discuss too is this idea that says, take all the leaders and execute them in broad daylight before the Lord. This idea of executing is going to be an impalement that is done in broad daylight in front of everybody to see that this is something you don't do. It's a very harsh punishment for the people. Not that they don't deserve it, but it was pretty direct about what should be done. Then behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel, while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, his grandson now, the priest saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation and took a spear in his hand. He went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through the man of Israel and the woman through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked. Those who died by the plague were 24,000. So at this point, there's a plague that's also going through Israel that we just find out about in these verses. So 24,000 people have died. But there's this man, and right now they just call him a man of Israel, who had taken this Midianite woman and was going to blatantly disobey God, go into this tent, and do something that was wrong in a sexual way. Laura, I'm sorry, this is just kind of, I'm not going to be graphic, but it's ugly what happens here. Because the man, Phinehas, is going to see what's happening, and he's going to have righteous indignation over this event. And it angers him to the point where he grabs a spear and he goes in, and while the two are in there, he stabs them through, first the man and then the woman. Not because they were together, it was just one boom, and they're both dead, and it's ugly. But by him doing that, more people aren't killed by the plague. God is satisfied by that. It goes on to say, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, and that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I did not destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace, and it shall be for him and his descendants after him a covenant of perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. The word jealousy that it uses here is only used a couple other times. And the first jealousy, it takes place in the early part of Exodus, and that's when God's handing down the law, and God says, I am a jealous God, in terms of his care for his people and his anger over people not loving him and obeying him the way they should. The other place this is used is associated with a husband who believes his wife has been unfaithful to him, and he is jealous. And it's that type of rage and anger that's shown here. And similarly, Phinehas displays that when he takes upon himself to basically clean house and take care of the sinful situation that's going on. Now the name of the slain man of Israel who was slain with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of a father's household among the Simeonites. The name of the Midianite woman who was slain was Cozbi, the daughter of Zur, who was head of the people of a father's household in Midian. Now Cozbi, her name means deceiver, okay, and we'll see a little bit more about that in a minute. But those are the folks involved. So these aren't just run-of-the-muck, everyday Israelites. These were leaders within their culture. And he was being blatant about how he felt about this worship and how he was just going to put it in their face. This is what I'm going to be. And God said, nope. And Phinehas took up the action like he needed to. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, be hostile to the Midianites and strike them. For they have been hostile to you with their tricks with which they have deceived you in the affair of Peor, and in the affair of Cozbi, the daughter of the leader of Midian, their sister who was slain on the day of the plague because of Peor. Now I jumped into Numbers 31. The reason I did that is kind of behind the scene, because we're not given this information until 31. Pastor will talk about this incident a little bit later. And actually, I jumped too far ahead. But what's going to happen, remember it said be hostile towards Midianites, right? The be hostile is an imperative? But it's like be very hostile kind of thing. There's going to be a fight, and it's going to be a bad fight for the people of Midian and Moab and the Moabites that are there, because they're going to wipe out a lot of, they're going to wipe out the men. But the women and the cattle and the children, they're going to bring back to them. And this is this is Moses talking back to them, saying, "Have you spared all the women? Behold, these caused the sons of Israel through the counsel of Balaam to trespass against the Lord in the matter of Peor. So the plague was among the congregation of the Lord." What I want y'all to see from this is that same Balaam who wouldn't curse them was the one that was going to tell them, basically, this is how you deceive them. This is a way to weaken them. If you will, he was a betrayer of the worst kind. He told them, "Yeah, I can't curse them, but if you get them to sin, if you break that relationship with God, that'll wipe them out." They didn't even have to pick up a spear, and 24,000 people died because of their sin. He knew that sin would separate them from the blessing of God.
Go that route, like, all right, obviously we can't spear them, but we're going to, you know, make them suffer.
But Balaam was also arrogant enough to think that, hey, God's not going to hurt me. He didn't before. I don't have to fear him. Y'all have to fear him. I'm not an Israelite. That's kind of silly. Hosea also goes on. This whole event is going to be talked about throughout the Old Testament, or at least referred to through the Old Testament. Hosea tells us, "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your forefathers as the earliest fruit on the fig tree in its first season. But they came to Baal Peor and devoted themselves to shame, and they became as detestable as that which they loved." It's pretty ugly, isn't it? Now then, my question now is, why is this event included in Numbers? Why did they recount this thing, do you think?
It's not as serious as the sin, maybe.
Yep, definitely do that.
And all the people that passed away, I know that God had, like, everyone over the age of 20 died. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. And like Miss Wanda was talking about, this sin, this is like the third time now where they've had this, like, this major incursion of sin. First one was the golden calf, right? And then there's the rebellion of Korah, where folks were wiped out, and now this one. These things were written down for us to learn from.
But this is also a recurring sin for Israel.
Yes.
It's the joining with foreign women.
Yep. Now, one of the things, just starting out, it demonstrates God's grace to the people, because they saw the sinfulness, and yet God didn't wipe them out. God was merciful to them, associated with that. Now, Moses experiences restoration in his relationship with God, and I talked to Pastor Tim about that. And this is a very subtle difference that they talk about in terms of when the Lord said to Moses versus when the Lord spoke to Moses. Prior to his sin associated with the waters at Meribah, it was the Lord spoke to Moses. And Pastor said that's maybe something akin to God came and spoke to Moses, versus after he sinned, it was the Lord said to Moses, in almost like a dictating fashion, and God didn't necessarily come to him, so to speak. But after this, we see the Lord spoke to Moses again. So there's some type of restoration that took place. Pastor, is there anything else I should add or not add for that? It's just, it was a small nuance, and it was in the notes that I had, and I just wanted to bring that to your attention. It also serves as a reminder, like Miss Wanda was saying, Molly was saying, it serves as a reminder to new generations of the consequences of rejecting God's sovereign rule over their lives through the worship of other deities, like you were talking about. And then the response of Phinehas has become an example of defending the sanctity of Israel in the tent of meeting. One of the things about Phinehas, this is going to be a reaffirmation of the covenant made to Aaron about the priesthood. And it's just going on, God goes on to bless Phinehas and say, you know, priesthood's going to remain within the family line. Now that takes care of chapter 25. Y'all have any questions about that? I don't want to jump too fast or go too quick on that one. Chapter 26 is 63 verses or 60 some odd verses of census, but I just have a quick synopsis on that thing. The reason we're doing a census is this is a new generation. Like I said, we've been 38 plus years wandering through the desert. Those over the age of 20 have now passed away. On the other side of it now, Moses, who's been walking through the desert, has been walking pretty much and watching his sister die, his brother die, pretty much the folks he came out of Egypt with the exception of which two, Laura? Who do not die? Which ones? Yeah, you do. Joshua and... Yep, those are the two that make it with him, okay? But Moses has been watching all these folks die, and he also knows that he won't be going there. But we have this census to take. And so this is just a eye chart for you on numbers and the tribes. The first census in the one column, the second census in the middle column there, and then the change in that. So who took the biggest hit during this 40 years of wandering? Which tribe? The parenthesis means it's a negative number. Simeon, yeah. Yeah, Simeon took a big hit, right? 37,100 folks passed away or declined in population for that. And part of that is associated with our friend over there, Zimri, who had sinned. He was a Simeonite, and probably folks from that tribe were following him as well, and they were wiped out by part of that plague. Do what?
Dan and Judah.
Well, Manasseh, they gained 20,000 folks there. So God blessed them mightily during that wandering in the desert and everything. But why is it important to get census information? What's going to happen? Yeah, they're going into the new land. God's going to tell them that for the bigger tribes, more people, you're going to have a larger inheritance. For the smaller tribes, you're going to have a smaller inheritance. Pretty much everyone's going to have an inheritance. It's going to be given out by lot. But he does make accommodations for those that have larger families, if you will, that they're going to get a bigger portion of the real estate there. Yes, sir.
With that logic, I'm not disagreeing with it at all.
Yeah.
But look what happened to Simeon as a result of their leadership. They were permanently declined in their position as a result of this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really significant.
Yeah. And I'd almost venture to say it even goes back to when Jacob blessed them and Simeon had been one of the ones that had disobeyed. He was one of the older brothers and he had disobeyed. So he wasn't blessed like the other ones. It wasn't until we got to Judah that Judah received the blessing. Thank you, Pastor. Good observation. Numbers 26 ends like this. These are those who were numbered by Moses and Eleazar the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the plains of Moab by the Jordan at Jericho. But among these were not a man of those who were numbered by Moses and Aaron the priest, who numbered the sons of Israel in the wilderness at Sinai. For the Lord had said to them, "You shall surely die in the wilderness." Not a man was left of them except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. So Moses is very detailed in this census, saying everyone over the age of 20 that God said was going to die, they died. We did not count them. This is the new generation that's going to be going in there. Yes, sir.
No. What determined who was in what tribe? Mm-hmm. The mother was from Benjamin and the father was from Simeon.
the Father.
It's the Father.
It's the Father.
Which would be a problem here in a couple of
chapters. That we are going to talk about in chapter 27 as we look into this. They're going to talk some of the inheritance, and there's some legislation that goes, they call it legislation, laws or whatever, that start speaking to special situations, kind of like that. Pardon?
Some of those people didn't have any sons.
Yes. That's it. Then the daughters of Zelophehad had, I hope, sorry, Laura, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, came near, and these are the names of his daughters, Mahala, Noah, and Hogla, and Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moses, and before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders of all the congregation at the doorway of the tent of the meeting, saying, they're doing this very respectfully. They're coming to the tent of meeting where they need to come. They're not raising their argument in the public or anything else. They're bringing it through the proper channels. Our father died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah. But he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. So Moses brought their case before the Lord. So first of all, they're saying their father, who is, he doesn't have a son. He also didn't participate in the rebellion of Korah. He does acknowledge that, they do acknowledge the fact that he died in his own sin. He wasn't perfect, but he wasn't the perfect man or anything like that, but he died like everyone else. But he didn't have anything to leave to anybody, at least a son, that is. Excuse me if I struggle getting that out. But matters of land and inheritance were important to the Israelites. That was something that their culture centered around, that for the Israelites. And so the disappearance of a family name was often associated with either divine judgment or at least societal abandonment, they call it. In other words, say the Schultzes weren't here. Well, they must have done something wrong. God wiped them out for some reason. And the ladies are coming to Moses saying, hey, what about us? Dad wasn't that bad a guy. He wasn't associated with that rebellion. Yes, he died, but it wasn't associated with that type of sin or anything. Now, Moses, to his credit, also, this is the first time for Moses, and he doesn't shoot from the hip saying, well, this is what we're going to do. No, he brings it to the Lord to figure out what needs to be done, what's proper. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, the daughters of Zelophehad are right in their statement. Wouldn't you like to hear that, though? God says I was right. I just like that. You shall surely give them an hereditary possession among their father's brothers, and you shall transfer the inheritance of their fathers to them. Further, you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. Now, this is a big deal right here, because now women are allowed to have possession of land. It hadn't been that way before, but it's huge. He goes on to put these caveats in there. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his nearest relative in his own family, and he shall possess it, and it shall be a statutory ordinance to the sons of Israel, just as the Lord commanded Moses. So women could receive property via inheritance, and the land inheritance now, as we look at that, as well as the family preservation, family name preservation, those things are going to be intertwined and go on for a long time. It's a big deal when they put this statutory ordinance in there. That means it's going to be the law, and that's how things are going to be handled.
Mm-hmm. still goes to the daughters first, kind of?
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily go to the mother.
Okay.
They're talking about his descendants.
Okay.
It's, there's like dad and then son that should go to. If son's not there, then daughter.
Okay, so it's more, okay.
Yeah.
Whoever the heir was also responsible.
Responsible for taking care of.
Right, right.
She was not left.
Yeah. And I imagine she used that to her. Her. Let's see. So that takes care of the law portion of it. Now we come to this part talking about Moses. And the Lord said to Moses, go up to this mountain. And it just jumps over here. Go to this mountain of Abiram and see the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. When you have seen it, you too will be gathered to your people, as Aaron your brother was. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to treat me as holy before their eyes at the water. These are the waters of Meribah at Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. So this is going to be a reminder to the people also, as this is documented, that God's leaders are not immune from judgment associated with their own sin. They were accountable too. Can't just say, don't worry about that, Moses. It was just a mistake. They were accountable to it. God had every right to do that, but he chose not to. I went on a little bit into Deuteronomy chapter 3, and I wanted to do this because I'm often had this picture in my mind of Moses hearing those words that he can't go in, and that's the end of the conversation. But in Deuteronomy chapter 3, actually in 1, 2, and 3, Moses is recounting their time in the desert. And he writes about himself. I also pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, you have begun to show your servant your greatness and your strong hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do such works and mighty acts as yours? Let me, I pray, cross over and see the fair land that is beyond the Jordan, that good hill country in Lebanon. So he really wants to go see it. See, I never saw Moses like that in terms of really wanting to see it. I figured he did, but I didn't know he really verbalized it to God like that. But this is God's answer to it, and it's rather strict and stern. But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. And the Lord said to me, enough, speak to me no more of this matter. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift up your eyes to the west and north and south and east, and see it with your eyes, for you shall not cross over this Jordan. That's just the hammer coming down, and Dad says, no, you're not going over there. And yet Moses, in all the things he did, you don't see him being disobedient, or at least it's not documented anywhere, him throwing a fit because he didn't get his way. Moses accepts God's judgment on these things. Moses goes on to say in Numbers, we're back in Numbers now. Then Moses said to the Lord, saying, may the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep which have no shepherd. So why is Moses asking for this? What do you think, Ms. Karen? What do you think he feared for the people?
What they had been doing before.
Yeah. He called them sheep, right?
Yeah.
Sheep aren't exactly on the top of the food chain, are they? We can be pretty stupid. And he saw that they could easily be led astray, right? Have the right charismatic guy come in there and they'd do whatever he told them to do. So he's expressing their concern about the leadership. If I can't be there, then who's going to be there? But he also does something, I think, which is very wise and gracious on his part. He doesn't suggest some name and say, please make so-and-so a leader. He knows that God looks at the heart, and he knows who the best leader is for that position. God responds to him. So the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hands on him, and have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and commission him in their sight. You shall put some of your authority on him in order that all the congregation of the sons of Israel may obey. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At his command they shall go out, at his command they shall come in, both he and the sons of Israel, with him even all the congregation. Moses did just as the Lord commanded him, and took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest, and before all the congregation. And he laid his hands on him and commissioned him, just as the Lord had spoken through Moses. So this is the way Numbers chapter 27 ends for us. We see Moses carrying out what he was supposed to for Joshua. But we also see now kind of somewhat of a divided leadership. Moses had been the head man who took care of all the spiritual needs, who made leadership decisions, who made military decisions. He may not have executed the leadership out on the battlefield, but he was the one that got everybody going, telling them who we're going to fight and that kind of thing. Now we're going to see it divided. Joshua's going to be doing the military and somewhat the administrative side of things. All the spiritual decisions and spiritual leadership is going to come from Eleazar. Joshua doesn't have that privilege to go straight to God, say, what do I do now kind of thing. He has to go to Eleazar, who in turn goes to God. So it's going to be a new model of leadership for them, in which they're going to carry on through the period of Judges, at least, well, I shouldn't say Judges, until Joshua's death. At that point, every man did what was right in his own eyes, right? In Judges. So what does this mean to us today? What we've read, gone through Numbers 25, 26, and 27. What do y'all take from this? What do I apply to my life today? Is it just facts?
My mind first is that we truly have a forgiving God.
Yes.
And that was giving good examples there, because by man's judgment, they didn't deserve any mercy.
No.
By deliberately disobeying.
Mm-hmm. Repeatedly, right?
Yes.
Yep.
But he's also very just and negative. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And as, you know, God, him as an example, like, no, you sinned, this is your consequence.
Yep. There are consequences for leaders, right?
Yeah.
What else? I'm going to step back just a little bit to Balak. Remember Balak and Balaam wanting, he wanted them to be cursed so that he could go in and beat them up, right? Somewhat of a direct attack. We're going to go in and just kill people. But that didn't work too well for him, right? It was that indirect stuff that he tried, destroying them from within. Does that apply to us today? Do we get beat up on the inside or attacked from the inside? Our Constitution tells us that we can meet here freely and worship, which is great. But our Constitution also says that things can be broadcast over the television and over internet, and all that stuff can come into our homes. And in the sanctity of those four walls, that some of that stuff is pretty ugly stuff that we can be exposed to and corrupt us from the inside, destroy us from the inside, and break that relationship that we have with God on the inside. They didn't have those kind of luxuries, but they certainly were destroyed from the inside. Let's see. I put a note on here that we're all leaders, whether it's at home or at work or in the community. And it's a privilege that God has given us, and it makes us also accountable to Him in our service to Him. So those kind of things, that destruction from the inside, that's what affects us. Kind of close also, where did I put my Bible? It's Wanda, there it is. My Bible. Remember I told y'all that there were other places in the Old Testament that referenced this event that happened in Numbers. Micah does it also. And this is several hundred years later. And he writes to the people, a sinful people, indeed, and this is God talking, indeed I brought you up from the land of Egypt and ransomed you from the house of slavery. I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. My people remember now what Balak, king of Moab, counseled, and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered him. And from Shittim to Gilgal, in order that you might know the righteous acts of the Lord. With what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before the God on high? And this is Israel's reply. Shall I come to him with burnt offerings, with yearling calves? Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams or in 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Those are the words of Micah, based on the things that we talked about. And I always like to do like the cultural enrichment thing for you. And there was a song a few years ago from Stephen Curtis Chapman called The Walk.